Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're heading to Paris, but we aren't going to the Eiffel Tower or the Louvre.
No.
We are heading up the hill to the Montmartre Quarter, right at the turn of the 20th century. It's a place of smoke, velvet, absinthe, and a very specific windmill.
We are talking, of course, about the Moulin Rouge.
But not just the historical club, we are looking at the massive sensory overload stage adaptation of Baz Luhrmann's 2001 film. This is Moulin Rouge, the musical. And honestly, looking at the calendar, this feels like a bit of a wake.
It really does feel that way. Today is February 16th, 2026. And if you've been watching the Broadway trade papers, you know, the news dropped recently. After years of confetti and can-can dancers, the Broadway production is closing its doors on July 26, 2026.
That is coming up so fast. It's wild to think about because this show has been such a behemoth in New York. It feels like it's been there forever. But, looking at the timeline, it only opened in 2019.
Opened in 2019, survived a global pandemic, and came back roaring. So today isn't just a summary, it's a retrospective. We're looking at a show that kind of defined the post-Hamilton era of the mega musical.
Right, and we've got a massive stack of notes here: production history, casting changes, and a really detailed breakdown of the plot differences between the movie and the stage show. Because, and I say this as someone who wore out the DVD of the movie in college, they are not the same
They
beast.
really aren't. And that's the mission today. To figure out how you take a movie that was already a fever dream. I mean, Baz Luhrmann's editing style is basically a panic attack set to music and translate that energy to a live stage without giving the audience a migraine.
Let's start with the noise, the music. The movie was famous for being a jukebox musical, but that term feels almost disrespectful to what they did on stage. Jersey Boys is a jukebox musical. Mamma Mia is a jukebox musical. This feels heavier.
The industry has started calling these catalog musicals. But even that doesn't quite capture it. I like to think of it as a collage, a high-speed sonic collage.
Right, because usually a jukebox musical takes one artist, say The Temptations, and tells their life story. Or they take ABBA songs and shoehorn a plot around them, but Moulin Rouge uses, well, everything.
It uses the catalog of pop culture itself. And this is the first major hurdle the production team had to clear. The movie came out in 2001, the musical opened in 2019. Think about how much music happened in those 18 years.
That's a lifetime in pop music. I mean, the movie had Lady Marmalade and Your Song. If they had just stuck to the movie soundtrack, it would have felt like a period piece about the early 2000s, not a timeless story.
Precisely. They had to update the playlist. The score includes songs written in the 17 years after the movie premiered. So while you're watching characters in corsets and top hats in 1899, you're hearing Beyoncé, you're hearing Katy Perry, you're hearing Sia.
It's such a weird cognitive dissonance, but it works. You're in 19th century Paris. Satine is flying in on a swing, and suddenly she's belting Chandelier.
It's the megamix approach. And we have to give credit to the music supervisor and orchestrator, Justin Levine. I mean, think about the legal nightmare of this show. They had to clear rights for something like 70 different songs.
70.
Yeah, 70 from different publishers, different songwriters, different eras.
That sounds like a lawyer's version of hell.
It likely was. But artistically, Levine had to stitch them together so they didn't sound like a bad DJ set. Take Satine's entrance number, The Sparkling Diamond. In the movie, it was mostly Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend and Material Girl.
Iconic. Nicole Kidman in the sequence.
On stage, they kept the bones of that, but they mashed it up with Diamonds Are Forever by Shirley Bassey, Single Ladies by Beyoncé, and Rihanna's Diamonds.
So you have Marilyn Monroe meeting Rihanna.
And it flows seamlessly. They match the tempos, they adjust the keys. It creates this frenetic energy that mimics the quick-cut editing of the film. In the movie, the camera zooms and pans to keep you excited. On stage, the music changes every 10 seconds to keep your brain engaged.
It's like TikTok scrolling before TikTok existed.
Exactly. It hooks into the dopamine centers of the brain. You get the thrill of recognition. Oh, I know that song. Followed immediately by the surprise of the next one.
The best example of this has to be the Elephant Love Medley.
Oh, for sure.
In the movie, this is the scene where Christian and Satine are on top of the giant elephant statue, and they're arguing about whether they should fall in love.
It's a musical debate. And in the stage version, it is a masterclass in lyrical dialogue. They aren't just singing at each other, they are using pop lyrics to make their points.
I was looking at the track list for this medley, and it's just insane. They start with the Beatles, All You Need Is Love, then it jumps to Just One Night by Eric Clapton.
Then Pride, In the Name of Love by U2, Can't Help Falling in Love. Even Torn by Natalie Imbruglia makes an appearance.
Torn. That's a deep cut for 1899.
But notice the function. By using Torn, or, you know, I Will Always Love You, the show shortcuts the emotional heavy lifting.
How so?
The audience already has an emotional connection to those songs. You don't need to spend 3 minutes establishing a melody to make the audience feel sad. You just play the opening chords of a Whitney Houston song, and the audience is already there.
It weaponizes nostalgia.
It bridges the gap.
Mm.
The costumes say history, but the music says now. It tells the audience that these feelings, love, jealousy, desperation, are modern feelings.
Speaking of feelings, let's talk about the people having them. For anyone who hasn't seen the show or the movie, set the stage for us.
We're in the Montmartre Quarter. The club is the Moulin Rouge, run by Harold Zidler.
Zidler is the ringmaster. In the movie, he was this larger-than-life, slightly grotesque figure.
He's the MC, and he is in deep, deep trouble. The club is bankrupt. The glitz is a facade. He needs money, or the lights go out and everyone is on the street.
Enter the innocent American.
And here is the first major character shift. In the movie, Christian was English, played by Ewan McGregor. On stage, Christian is American. Specifically, he's from Lima, Ohio.
Lima, Ohio. That is very specific. Why the change?
It just emphasizes his naivety. He's not just a European romantic. He is a total outsider. He arrives in Paris with a head full of dreams and like zero street smarts. He's looking for the bohemian ideals. Truth, beauty, freedom, and love.
And he falls in with the bohemians immediately. Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec and Santiago.
Lautrec, the real-life painter, and Santiago, the Argentinian choreographer. They're trying to write a show to pitch to Zidler. They need a songwriter. Christian stumbles in, sings a few notes, and suddenly he's the savior of the production.
But to get the show made, they need Satine.
The sparkling diamond, the star of the Moulin Rouge. And this brings us to, I think, the most critical update in the adaptation, Satine's agency.
This stood out to me in the notes. In the movie, Satine felt a bit like a leaf blowing in the wind. She was very reactive.
On stage, she is older. She is a mentor to the other dancers. Nini, Le Chocolat, Arabia, Baby Doll. She isn't just trying to get famous. She is trying to save her family. She feels the weight of the club's finances on her shoulders.
Plus, she's dying. We can't forget the consumption.
Tuberculosis.
Yeah.
The ticking clock. And she hides it from everyone, because if the investors know the star is dying, well, the money dries up.
So the setup is, Zidler arranges for Satine to seduce the Duke of Monroth, the rich investor. Satine mispakes Christian for the Duke. Christian sings Your Song, the Elton John classic, and she falls for him. Then the real Duke walks in.
And this is where the adaptation gets really smart. In the movie, the Duke was, well, he was a cartoon. He was goofy, he had a high-pitched voice. He was just so easy to hate.
He was practically twirling his mustache.
Exactly. But on stage, the Duke is dangerous, he's charismatic, he's sexy, he's a legitimate rival for Christian.
That changes the whole dynamic. If the Duke is a total creep, Satine's choice is easy. But if the Duke offers stability, wealth, and isn't repulsive?
It creates genuine dramatic tension. The Duke represents survival. Christian represents love, but love doesn't pay the rent. In the stage version, Satine actually enters a sexual relationship with the Duke pretty much immediately to secure the funding.
That's a much darker turn than the film.
It is. It removes the fairy tale aspect and grounds it in a harsh reality. Satine is making a transactional choice to save her friends. It makes her sacrifice so much more tangible.
And the show they pitch, the play within a play, that's different too. In the movie, it was spectacular. Spectacular, that Bollywood thing.
On stage, they pitch a show called Bohemian Rhapsody.
Which is a clever nod to Queen, obviously, but it also fits the theme better.
It allows them to mirror the plot of the musical itself. The play they are writing is about a gangster, a sailor, and a courtesan. The Duke plays the bankster. Christian plays the sailor. So the lines between reality and the play start to blur.
This blurring of reality leads to the climax, which is where the show completely diverges from the film. And honestly, this is the part that hit me the hardest reading the script.
It's a massive tonal shift. In the movie, the end is chaotic. The Duke brings a gun to the premiere. He tries to shoot Christian. It's an external threat.
Right. But on stage, the threat is internal.
Christian unravels. He is consumed by jealousy. He's drinking absinthe. And in the second act, during the premiere of Bohemian Rhapsody, he storms the stage. But he doesn't fight the Duke.
No.
He pulls a gun and points it at himself.
He threatens suicide right there in front of the audience.
It stops the show cold. It turns the spectacle into a tragedy about mental health and despair. He basically says, if I can't have you, I'll remove myself from the equation.
That is heavy. How does the show resolve that without being incredibly depressing?
Satine saves him. She breaks character. She sings their secret song, Come What May. It's the moment she drops the mask. She proves she loves him not just to him, but to the Duke and the whole audience.
She talks him down.
She saves his soul. But she can't save her own body. The exertion kills her. She dies in his arms right as the curtain falls.
It's tragic, but I guess it fulfills the tragedy requirement of a great opera or great romance.
And it leaves Christian behind to tell the story. The greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return. That's the thesis statement.
Let's zoom out a bit. We've covered the story and the music, but we need to talk about the production itself, because getting this thing to Broadway was a saga in its own right.
It was a marathon. It started out of town in Boston at the Emerson Colonial Theater in 2018. That standard practice workout, the kinks, see if the megamix works on a live crowd.
And it clearly did. They moved to the Al Hirschfeld Theater on Broadway in June 2019, and they didn't just move in, they gutted the place.
They transformed the theater. If you walked into the Hirschfeld, you weren't in a New York theater anymore. They built a giant red windmill on one side of the auditorium and a massive blue elephant on the other. The stage extended out into the audience. It was immersive before immersive was a buzzword.
It was a massive hit. Tickets were impossible to get. And then, March 12, 2020.
The day the lights went out, Broadway shut down for COVID-19. Moulin Rouge went dark just like everything else. But unlike a small play, this was a massive machine with hundreds of employees.
And it stayed dark for a long time. They didn't reopen until September 2021. That's an 18-month intermission.
And during that intermission, the world changed.
Yeah.
And the cast changed. We have to address the Karen Olivo situation.
Right. Karen Olivo was the original Broadway Satine, a powerhouse performer. But she didn't come back when the show reopened.
She resigned in protest. This was during the time when allegations of abuse and bullying were coming out against producer Scott Rudin. Now, Rudin wasn't producing Moulin Rouge. But Olivo felt that the industry's response, the silence, was unacceptable.
Yeah.
She essentially said, I can't work in a system that values money over human dignity.
Which, ironically, is a very bohemian stance to take. Truth and freedom over money.
It is. It sparked a huge conversation on Broadway about safety and workplace toxicity. So when the show reopened, Natalie Mendoza took over the role. Fun fact, Natalie Mendoza was actually a dancer in the original 2001 movie. She played China Doll. So it was a full circle moment for her.
Despite the drama and the delay, the industry decided to reward the show heavily.
It was a sweep. 14 Tony nominations, 10 wins, including Best Musical.
Aaron Chivett, who played Christian, finally won his Tony.
He was actually the only person nominated in the Best Actor category that year because of the shortened season due to COVID. But he still needed 60% of the vote to win, and he got it.
And Danny Burstein won for Zidler. It felt like a victory lap for the production design, too. Best scenic design, best lighting, best costumes.
It was the show Broadway needed at that moment. It was big, loud, expensive, and joyful. It told the world that Broadway was back.
But not every critic was popping champagne.
No. And this is the eternal critique of Baz Luhrmann's work, whether on screen or stage, is its style over substance. The New York Times loved it, calling it a cloud-surfing natural high. But The Guardian and others felt it had a hollow emotional core.
I can see that. When you have confetti cannons going off every 5 minutes, you really care that Satine is dying?
That's the trade-off. Some critics felt the spectacle drowned out the tragedy. They argued that the characters were just mannequins for the songs. But looking at the box office, the audience didn't care. They wanted the party.
And the party went global. London, Australia, Korea, Japan.
The German production in Cologne is fascinating to me. They translated the songs.
Wait, they translated the mashups?
Yes. Imagine the technical difficulty of that. You had to translate Material Girl and Diamonds Are Forever into German, make them rhyme, make them fit the melody, and ensure they still lock together in the mashup.
Wow.
That is a linguistic puzzle that I can't even wrap my head around.
And clearly it worked. The show has legs. But even the best parties have to end. Which brings us back to today.
February 2026. The show closes in July. It will have played over 2,200 performances.
That puts it in the pantheon of long runners. It's not Phantom of the Opera length, but it's a solid run.
It is. And its closing marks a shift. Moulin Rouge was one of the last pre-pandemic blockbusters. It represents an era of more is more. As it leaves, we're seeing a shift on Broadway towards smaller, perhaps more introspective works, or different kinds of spectacles.
So if you're listening to this and you can get to New York before July 26, 2026, go see The Elephant.
Absolutely. Even if you hate jukebox musicals, you have to appreciate the sheer scale of the engineering. It's a technical marvel.
And if you can't make it, there's always the Cast album.
Released in 2019, it captures the energy surprisingly well. Put on headphones, close your eyes, and you can almost smell the absinthe.
Before we sign off, I want to leave you with a thought. We talk about Moulin Rouge as the ultimate love story. All you need is love. But when you look at the stage version, really look at it, with the darker, sexier Duke, the financial desperation of Satine, and the suicidal ideation of Christian Sochin, is it a love story?
Or is it a cautionary tale about what happens when you try to live in a fantasy world while the real world is demanding its rent?
That's the question. Thanks for diving deep with us today.
Overfell.